Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. In this week's report, I start off with several news items that reveal a U.S. government and president out of control. Charging white genocide in South Africa, threatening more high tariffs, proposing the use of foreign aid to repatriate foreigners, engaging in cryptocurrency corruption. First, Trump's false charge of white genocide in South Africa. Trump once again is engaging in reverse racism, charging that an oppressor class is the victim. In this case, it's white South Africans who are the supposed victims of genocide, on the strength of nothing more than a frenzied white lobbyist who got Trump's ear. It started with giving these Afrikaners special immigration status to emigrate to the U.S., at the same time that the administration is systematically removing Venezuelans, Haitians, and others from the U.S. Trump is also pressuring the South African government of Cyril Ramaphosa, who recently visited Washington, to change its racial equity laws. As usual, Trump ignores South Africa's history of apartheid and mixes acts of violence against Afrikaners with genocide to intervene with deliberate ignorance in another country's affairs. He showed Ramaphosa a video intended to prove black-on-white violence, but in fact it was a lurid scene taken in the Democratic Republic of Congo, not in South Africa. A South African journalist offered this view in the New York Times, quote, "Contrary to the claims in Mr. Trump's order, there is no evidence that the civil rights of white South Africans have been systematically trampled on, or that white landowners face disproportionate violence. They own farms that occupy about half of South Africa's area, despite making up around 7% of the population. No white-owned land or home has been forcibly taken by the government under a new land law mentioned in Mr. Trump's order." Unquote. Trump's demands were doubtless inspired by Elon Musk, who wanted his Starlink communication system to be adopted in his home country. U.S. aid to South Africa, including aid to fight HIV, has been cut off, high tariffs have been imposed on South African exports to the U.S., and a South African ambassador has been expelled. Trump also reportedly wanted South Africa to change a law that forces U.S. and other multinational corporations to allow black South Africans to buy equity in them. Trump's pressure tactics worked. Just days after Ramaphosa left for home, the Starlink system was adopted, and the law requiring black South African investment in them was overturned. Next, Trump threatens to resume the tariff war. He lashed out at the European Union and said he would apply a 50% tariff to European exports, starting in just over a week. A few days later, he reversed himself on the tariffs, postponing them and saying that he was open to negotiations. Perhaps he was influenced by estimates like this one from the Kiel Institute for the World Economy, a German economic research institute, which showed that the tariffs would lead to a 20% drop in exports from the European Union to the U.S. in the short term, as well as more than 6% increase in prices in the U.S. By one count, Trump has reversed himself on tariffs over 50 times. A third example of Trump out of control, his use of foreign aid to repatriate foreigners. Don't remind the Trump administration that it has cut foreign aid to the bone. Seems there's enough to use to get rid of Ukrainian, Haitian, and other migrant populations in the U.S., sending them home to appalling conditions with money that's supposed to be used for humanitarian assistance. That idea is in the works, using $250 million to return migrants to their country of origin, even if the country is in a conflict zone. Oh, if an immigrant self-deports home, then he or she will get $1,000 from Homeland Security. Ukrainians and Haitians aren't the only people who might be affected. The Washington Post, which has seen the plan, says a draft also mentions Afghans, Libyans, Sudanese, Syrians, and Yemenis. My fourth example, the crypto president's corruption. Donald Trump continues to make money by trading on his office. His recent private dinner for mainly foreign investors in his meme coin added millions more to his coffers, while at the same time exposing the presidency to foreign influence. The New York Times published a list of the attendees, about three-fourths of whom were from abroad, mostly of Chinese origin. All expressed a fawning admiration for Trump. Senator Mark Kelly is seeking to end crypto corruption, according to a Senate bill he is co-sponsoring. The bill would ban the president, vice president, and their immediate families from, quote, issuing, endorsing, or sponsoring crypto assets. The bill specifically names meme coins, which would present an issue for this president, whose controversial meme coin, $Trump, sends about 75% of its revenue to his family. Kelly took direct shots at Trump while publicizing the bill, writing in a press release, quote, Trump is cashing in on his presidency and making millions from his own crypto coins. This is corruption in broad daylight. The press release also pointed out that the Trump family's net worth has increased by $2.9 billion as a result of his crypto investments, which Kelly now says make up nearly 40% of his wealth. Bills like these that seek to name and shame Trump's grifting don't have a ghost of a chance of being passed while Republicans rule the roost. In other news, reason for some optimism about U.S.-Iran talks. Writing in the New York Review, Christopher de Balague believes conditions are ripe for a grand bargain. The axis of resistance, Hezbollah, Syria, and Iran, has been weakened by Israel's warfare and the fall in Syria of Bashar al-Assad. The Saudis want a U.S.-Iran detente and reject attacking Iran. And while Israel remains the outlier, Trump wants a deal, even one that merely restores the terms of the 2015 nuclear deal. And he's in a position to override Prime Minister Netanyahu, who would like nothing better than a green light to attack Iran. Finally, Iran itself is in dire straits, as de Balague reports, quote, salaries are paid using the revenue from heavily discounted oil sales to China, and goods are bought from a variety of sources. In many cases, sanctions are circumvented with costly, inefficient, and corrupt methods that benefit a few at the expense of the many. Popular discontent finds expression in millions of women not wearing the mandatory hijab, and a rumble of protests against quotidian government failures, ranging from water shortages to pollution and power outages caused by shortages of the natural gas with which Iran is so abundantly endowed. The now-ousted finance minister in Iran said 10 million Iranians had fallen below the poverty line. Iran reportedly has proposed a very interesting approach to resolving the nuclear issue. The proposal is to establish a three-country nuclear consortium, including the U.S. and two Arab countries, in which Iran would enrich uranium to a low grade, beneath that needed for nuclear weapons, and then ship it to other Arab countries for civilian use. The low enrichment idea is the same one adopted in the 2015 nuclear deal that President Obama negotiated. But the addition of three countries to oversee the deal is new. No further news has come out on how this proposal has fared. U.S. support of international exchange programs may end. The Trump administration's slash-and-burn approach to government includes this item. Its fiscal year 2026 budget request proposes to cut State Department international exchange programs by $691 million, or 93%. Given the current budget is $741 million, this would leave only $50 million for all Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs programs and operations. Part and parcel of these budget cuts is Trump's war on Harvard. Not only is Trump seeking to end Harvard's tax-exempt status and cut off federal funding of Harvard research programs, his latest move terminates certification of Harvard's foreign student enrollments, forcing international students to go elsewhere. That means about 6,700 students are affected, or more than a quarter of Harvard's student body. The rationale provided by Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem is almost laughable. She linked Harvard not just to anti-Semitism, but also to support of terrorism and the Chinese Communist Party. And she warned that other schools better watch out, or the same shutdown will happen to them. Harvard's response was to condemn the move as unlawful, saying it is, quote, fully committed to maintaining Harvard's ability to host international students and scholars who hail from more than 140 countries and enrich the university and this nation immeasurably. The university is suing to block the administration's action. Serbia's pro-democracy protests continue. Serbia's far-right, nationalist, and authoritarian movement, once led by Slobodan Milosevic, returned to power in 2014 with the election of Aleksandar Vučić as prime minister. Since then, Serbia has experienced a democratic backsliding of the sort seen in Turkey and Hungary. The European Union has tolerated the eclipsing of press freedom, judicial independence, and civil society in Serbia because the economy has been reasonably productive and political stability has been maintained. But now, with the ruling party dominant in Serbian society to an exceptional degree, the opposition boycotted elections last year. One Serbian political scientist classifies the country as a semi-consolidated autocracy. The student-led protest that began last November was sparked by the collapse of a train station, killing 14 people. This happened despite repeated repairs to the station. Collusion between the government and contractors is said to be responsible. By the end of 2024, this spontaneous protest had gained support from all state universities and some private ones. Now, many towns and cities have joined the protest, which is marked by nonviolence and political inclusiveness. The protesters are demanding a return to the rule of law, accountable institutions, and direct democracy whenever possible. Snap elections are being called for universities and their faculties under direct threat from the government, in much the same way as here. Police and judges are under pressure to get tougher with the protesters. EU groups are now for the first time taking notice of this backsliding, and they're siding with the protesters. That puts Serbia's government on the spot, since it seeks EU membership. The outcome of this struggle is uncertain, but the far-right ruling party is under greater threat than ever before. Next, bizarre events in Philippines politics. Politics in the Philippines these days is a family affair. You're either affiliated with the family of current President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. or with the family of his predecessor, Rodrigo Duterte, and his daughter, Sara Duterte, who happens to be the vice president and faces an impeachment trial. In midterm elections for half the seats in the 24-member Senate just concluded, Marcos's allies lost support to Duterte's allies, making it likely that Sara Duterte will be able to avoid conviction. In another sign of Duterte's reemergence as a political force, he won election as mayor, even though he is incarcerated in the Netherlands, pending trial before the International Criminal Court on charges of crimes against humanity for his brutal war on drugs while he was president. A reset in Britain-EU relations. Britain reached a wide-ranging deal with the European Union, including a security and defense pact, and fewer restrictions on British food exporters and visitors. The agreement should boost the United Kingdom's economy on the agricultural side, since there will be fewer regulations, making food cheaper. But the heart of the reset is a defense agreement that will let Britain be part of any joint arms procurement and pave the way for British companies such as BAE and Rolls-Royce to take part in a 150 billion euro, that's about $167 billion, program to rearm Europe. The EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said in a statement, "At a time of global instability and when our continent faces the greatest threat it has for generations, we in Europe stick together." Finally, an update from last week's report on seabed mining by the Trump administration, which are planned to take place in international waters. My thanks to listener Scott, who has pointed me to an article in the Scientific American, which reports on seafloor mining tests being conducted offshore from Papua New Guinea in the South Pacific. The article's author attempted to determine the legality of the mining operations, but ran into a brick wall with the Papua New Guinea authorities. What is clear, the author writes, is that deep sea mining on a commercial scale will begin soon somewhere. Norway, the Cook Islands, Japan, and Sweden have approved deep sea mining in their exclusive economic zones. On the other side are Germany, Spain, and Chile, which have called for a pause because of uncertainty about the environmental impact. Palau and Fiji have advocated for a moratorium, and France wants an outright ban. A new deep-sea mining code is expected to be ready by year's end. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.